Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz and joined as always by Lahav Harkov. And this week, Lahav, I don't know if you heard, but the Israeli military has set up a secret unit. It's so secret that it only operates at sea, underwater. Well, I guess also sometimes these elite commandos can come above water to grab a breath of air. But what I'm referring to is this wacky report that came out in Al-Quds on Tuesday that claimed that the Israeli security forces used a dolphin to chase Hamas frogman commandos off the coast of the Gaza Strip. This was a claim that was apparently made by Hamas, and that Hamas naval operatives were chased into the sea by a dolphin that was equipped with a device capable of killing terrorists. Pretty cool.
It looked like they like held it up in a video that I saw, and it looks like almost like those little helmets that falcons wear, like in falconry, but with a tiny little gun attached to it. So it's you know, that would be pretty cool if we could do that. I have my doubts.
Well, first of all, I mean, if it's possible, I mean, you got to say, wow, like, you know, we thought Iron Dome was cool. The killer dolphins is even cooler.
They say dolphins are even more intelligent than people.
But so. And you know what? It's also, it's interesting. It's not the first time that this happened, right? Remember in about 11, 12 years ago, some South Sinai governor made a claim that deadly shark attacks in Sharm el-Sheikh were part of a Mossad operation to undermine the Egyptian tourism. And then the Saudis back in 2011 had a vulture that they put into detention because they suspected that it was spying for Israel.
But it was in that case, I think the vulture was actually tagged from Israel. Like, it was an animal, because there's all these migrating birds that fly under Israel, and there's Israeli, you know, Israelis study them. So I think that bird was tagged, and then they decided it was a spy.
It was probably tagged because it was like some, you know, endangered species. But then you also had the Turks,
right,
who in 2013 detained another spy bird. But then they released it after x-rays showed that it did not have embedded surveillance equipment. What the hell is going on with some of these countries that they think that Israel is like, we've mastered the control of animals to be able to spy on our enemies?
I think it's good that we live in these people's heads rent-free, you know, keeps them afraid of us, you know, keeps them from getting too out of hand.
I guess to an extent, but, you know, look, it also could be a part of the fact that Israeli military technology is so advanced, is sometimes almost, you know, science fiction-esque, right? Like, when you think about even Iron Dome, a little missile taking out another missile in the middle of the sky, the fact that Israel is rolling out soon these lasers and as technology, which almost is like, if you think about Star Trek force field like technology, that's what Israel is almost creating. So I guess they think that if we can do that, that we should also be able to arm a vulture, or a shark, a dolphin, or a bird.
Next, they'll say we built the Death Star.
Next. Yeah, I just, my son has become a big Star Wars fan over, you know, we used COVID, some of the earlier lockdowns to really, I brought him into the world of Star Wars, and we watched all nine.
It's important.
Very important. By the way, it's an interesting question, and I had to consult with some people. Do you watch them in the order that they came out, or if you're starting from scratch in 2020 or 2021, do you watch them in the order of the chronological order? And by the way, Lahav, you'd be surprised, a lot of disagreements here. A lot of people do different things.
Oh, I know. My husband and I have just had this conversation many times. One day we will show our kids those movies as well. I think that you should watch them in the order that they came out, by the way, so that you have the, you know, this is a decades old spoiler alert, so no one get mad at me, but so that you have the surprise of Darth Vader being Luke's father. Because if you watch them in the order of the story, then you lose what I think is like one of the biggest dramatic moments of the whole thing.
So I did the other way. We watched them chronologically.
Okay.
I felt that if we're starting from scratch with my son, I could get him into it from the beginning. It was a different way of watching. I watched all of them with him. There were lots of lockdown time on our hands, so we were able to get through them. But, which kind of ties in, I don't think that we're going to have that time of another lockdown. At least that doesn't look like that's what's happening right now based on the Israeli government's policy with regards to Omicron, which seems to be everywhere, by the way. I don't think anyone knows anyone. I mean, every day I'm hearing of another person who I know, family, colleague, friend, who's getting hit by this virus.
Yeah, including my family now. I have a one kid in quarantine. How I'm going to keep that one kid in quarantine separate from the other kid who's not supposed to be in quarantine is a big open question. The instructions are very confusing, and it really just like took hours for the entire WhatsApp group of the preschool to figure out what we're supposed to do. But you were saying there's not going to be a lockdown. I think that there's going to be a de facto lockdown, because right now they say about 10% of working adults are at home, and that by the next week or 2 weeks, it's going to be 30%. And so, you know, even if it's not officially a lockdown, it is slowing down the country in a big way.
You know, just about the point about the kids, you know, also with my four children, my oldest daughter has now her she's after high school, but the place, the Mechina, the post high school pre-military academy that she's learning at, they've shut down for the week now because there's a number of girls there who have contracted the virus. But someone sent out a funny joke the other day that said any message that starts with dear parents, because, you know, if you probably have a couple of WhatsApp groups with different kids and different guns, and I have with different classes and different of schools. Course. And every day we're getting a dear parent, right? Horim Yakarim. And then the message follows with we've detected this kid or we've discovered that kid. So someone writes any message that you get in WhatsApp that starts with dear parents, don't click on it because it's a virus, right?
Yes,
which
exactly.
is so true, because that's like we're doing antigens left, right, and center. I don't think there's a day that either Chai or I or one of the kids is not doing an antigen, because that's now the new rule, right? You come into contact with someone who's sick, you do an antigen. One of your kids is sick, you do an antigen. You suspect someone's sick, you do an antigen. You don't feel well, you do an antigen. It's antigen galore here.
Right, but the tests are so unreliable. And like, I think they said that it's only like 65% reliable, which is very low. I mean, I've already heard about multiple cases of false positives sure. and false negatives. And then they have this other thing for people who are unvaccinated, which for me is both of my children because they're under five. You have to get a what they call an institutional antigen test, which is the exact same test you do at home, but some kid standing in a parking lot where there's an hour-long line sticks the swab up your kid's nose instead right. of you. It's the most absurd thing.
It's totally absurd. And here's my question, which maybe you can shed some light on. So Naftali Bennett, Israel's prime minister, one of the things that he did quite well in the beginning of his term, right, he's been in office now for about 7 months, was combating the Delta variant, right? The Delta variant hit. He decided right away to do the third booster shot. That was over the summer, did it well. That was around August time. All of us got the third booster, and Israel kind of sailed past Delta quite safely, I'd say, right? With it seemed at the time minimal harm to the economy, not big numbers, and not a big spike in infections. This virus, though, he's really gone in a completely opposite direction. No, instead of restrictions, everything is open. Instead of saying, you know, we need more PCR tests, no, we'll do these unreliable antigen tests. In the beginning, he closed the skies. Now the skies are completely open. In the beginning, there were red states. Now there are no red states. There was the green pass. Now there is no green pass. What is he doing? A and B, how is this going to play out politically for him?
So some of it, I know what his explanations are. He really wanted to push a fourth booster shot, and really tried to even pressure the health officials to authorize it. But the health officials say that there's just not enough data and that they're not ready to do it, but they are doing it on the most vulnerable populations, but they're not ready to have widespread fourth boosters. I also think that a lot fewer people are going to get the fourth shot. I mean, just anecdotally from what I hear from people, even people who have gotten three shots, they're like, is this for real? Are we going to have to get another shot every 3 months? You know, that they're skeptical about it. As far as the closing down the skies, so a few months ago, Bennett led sort of like war games, but instead of war, it was pandemic games. And one of the things that that caused the game to be actually a very big failure and for COVID to spread really widely in the game was that the borders were left open. And so they sort of learned their lesson that they're supposed to close the borders. And so they did that. And of course, we speaking to sort of diaspora Jewish community leaders, heard a lot of complaints about that. In theory, that delayed Omicron in Israel. It looks by a couple of weeks. It took us maybe two, 3 weeks until Omicron spread as much as it was spreading already in Europe. now that it's spread and it's all over the place and it's really spreading exponentially, Bennett's logic is, well, it's here. And it, so closing the borders is not what's going to stop it or start it. It's not like that there are so many people entering Israel every day that it's going to make a big difference. So that's sort of their logic in general, that they want to think what is actually going to make a difference for people, and not have restrictions that don't do anything. But it looks like the only real restriction that would do anything is to have a lockdown. And that's the other thing that they don't want to do. They don't want to close down Israel's economy.
And they don't want to pay compensation to businesses that are not doing well. We saw Israeli Finance Minister Avigdor Lieberman, who said the other day, what do you mean? I went to a restaurant in Modi'in and it was packed with people. And then I saw somewhere the other day that the owner of that restaurant went on TV or radio and said, what are you talking about? I'm like suffering 40% losses, right? So like there was a nice cartoon in Yediot Ahronot, one of the widely circulated Hebrew newspapers in Israel, that showed Lieberman standing out of one of these pharmacies with a massive line of people trying to get in, which is obviously to buy those antigen tests because that's only where they sell them, and him saying, you see, I told you businesses are doing great. I mean, businesses are not doing great, right? People aren't going out much less. They're buying less. Less entertainment, less culture, less arts, less tourism, of course. He was the same guy, by the way, who said to the tourist operators, go get a new job, right? Change your profession. Yeah. That's a little callous, I think.
Lieberman is not someone who's known for his people skills. Right. Start with
but
that.
Again, Bennett needs to be thinking about the day after this. And if he was trying to leverage the success of Delta as, here, I actually know how to manage this crisis without needing to do a lockdown. So he's trying to avoid a lockdown now, but the infections are going out of control. And I don't know that there's anything he could do anymore, but also no compensation. I'm just not sure where he's looking at this from a political perspective. Or maybe he's not.
And it is a big argument within the coalition. It's not just like everybody agrees with Lieberman. I'm hearing, you know, a lot of ministers complaining. And not that that's like an excuse, you know, not that that makes it any better. But maybe over time there will be some kind of shift. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, you can't just keep people at home for so long and not compensate them.
That's true.
And by the way, this whole thing with the testing is like the PCR is more expensive than the antigen, and we don't have enough of them. And that's also part of the reason why we have this whole testing mess where we're all taking these very unreliable tests as opposed to the PCR, which is not perfect, but is a lot more reliable.
So from one prime minister to two former prime ministers, on Monday, we had a sight that you don't really see at all in Israel. Forget about every day. Two former prime ministers, Benjamin Netanyahu and Ehud Olmert, sitting in a courtroom together in Tel Aviv. We put the photo on the front page of our paper, in Tuesday's paper, of Ehud Olmert sitting on a bench and Bibi Netanyahu and his wife Sarah standing in the back, a security guard separating the two prime ministers, one from another. Lahav, why don't you tell our listeners what is going on and why are they in the same courtroom together in Tel Aviv?
Well, early last year, Ehud Olmert, former prime minister, former Jerusalem Post columnist as well, called the Netanyahus mentally ill. And the Netanyahus threatened to sue him. And then he gave another interview and he said it again. And he said he's not going to retract. And so now the Netanyahus have sued him for 837,000 shekels, which is, I mean, considering how strong the shekel is right now, close to $300,000 for damages. And it's just, I mean, first of all, I have to say, like, everyone should look up the analysis written by Herb Kanan about this, because it is very, very witty and fun, I would say. But it's just about how absurd this is. I mean, it's just a total, it's a circus, which is the word that the judge in the case used. You know, Olmert wanted medical records from the Netanyahu family to prove that they're mentally ill. And when the judge said he wouldn't order them to do that, then he said, well, you know, I'm speaking the truth. Like, I think it's an accurate characterization of them. You know, it's so incredibly undignified to see them both in court like
that. By the way, because it's not as if we're not talking about prime ministers who are familiar with court, right? We know that Ehud Olmert went to jail, famously, for corruption charges.
Yeah, speaking of undignified. Right.
Bibi Netanyahu is currently on trial for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. So he's facing his own criminal trial. And now the two of them are fighting out with one another. And like you said, the judge said this is a circus. The judge tried to get them to reach a compromise, right, and to settle. And Olmert would have to retract or apologize. And then – but and so he refused to do that. Netanyahu demanded still an apology. The pride and arrogance of these two people is not going to allow them to be able to settle this.
You know, I'm looking at our reporter, Yonah Bob's report on the trial, just to see if there was some sort of detail I missed. And there's a line that I can't help, but it just makes me laugh. It says, Olmert appeared to be mostly sending text messages, though he did engage the court a few times. I mean, to me, that's like a petulant teenager, right? Like when the parents are trying to talk to the teenager about something and they're only looking at their phone, right? Like, and that is our former prime minister.
I don't understand. I mean, also, I would say just about Netanyahu, like that's the worst you've been called. I mean, you know, come on, you got your own issues to deal with. There's no love between Olmert and Netanyahu. Netanyahu was one who famously called on Olmert to step down due to just police investigations. There wasn't even an indictment at the time back in 2008, 2009. He was indicted only after he had already resigned as prime minister. He was the one who also helped kind of motivate the protests that led to Olmert's resignation ultimately after the Second Lebanon War in 2006. So there's a lot of bad blood between
them.
But,
you know, it's not just that. I mean, it's bad blood, but also, like, if we're talking about, like, ugly insults, I mean, Netanyahu, the Likud has done so many of them. They basically called Gantz mentally ill the first time he ran. Right. They basically have been calling Ayelet Shaked the angel of death because she made some sort of comment.
You know what it is, Laha?
A little too flippant, but she said people are going to die.
You know what it is? And I was talking with her before he wrote that piece that you mentioned.
Yeah.
Is that when you're in the sewer, don't be surprised, this is what happens. And sadly, as I think you know, like I do, Israeli political discourse has been in the sewer for a long time, right? And when that is the culture and that is the rhetoric, don't be surprised that you're going to have two former prime ministers, very important people, men who carried the weightiest of decisions on their shoulders, from Iran to Syria to the Palestinian peace process to our strategic alliance with the United States to – you have it. And this is what they're dealing with.
By the way, our current prime minister, I don't think he's not done things that are this ugly, at least not lately, but he was a little bit dragged into the mud or allowed himself to be last week when, you know, he was being heckled incessantly by the opposition and they were calling him a fraud and they were saying, shame on you. And he walked over to them to like yell at them, which to me, like, it's like you're just giving them the attention that they want. You know, it's like one of these things, like, just ignore a bully. Like, you're the prime minister, you're supposed to be above it all. Like, just keep going, keep giving your speech. And then Orit Struk, a Knesset member for the Religious Zionist Party, who used to be in the same party as Bennett, and they used to be partners who worked very well together, she approached him, and he shouted at her, get out of my sight. Now, the like, damage control his office is doing is that, like, she wasn't masked, and she didn't want him.
Or get out of my face, maybe, also, right? Might be.
Yeah, I mean, in Hebrew, it's like my eyes. But yeah, so the damage control they're trying to do is that, like, she wasn't wearing a mask, and he was trying to tell her she needs to wear a mask, and he was annoyed, but no damage control is going to help that.
And the fact is that, unfortunately, we have too much of this that's happening. Lahav, just give us we have a great interview with Shoshana Keats-Chaskel. So why don't you just tell our listeners who that is and maybe set up for what that conversation was about.
She is the founder of Chochmat Nashim, which is an organization that advocates for religious women in all kinds of amazing ways. And I'll give an example that she didn't mention because we didn't have time to talk about all the things that the organization does. But for example, that they give materials to Haredi women about breast cancer because there's no sort of publicly available information because they don't want to talk about private parts of their bodies. But in the news these days, there's issues of sexual abuse in the Haredi community that we discuss. And of course, agunot, women whose husbands won't give them a religious get, a religious divorce. And she's really fascinating, and she's doing a lot of good things for women in Israel.
Yeah, that's without a doubt. And we spoke to her at length about the whole Chaim Walder, that Israeli Haredi author and therapist who was found to have abused sexually maybe dozens, allegedly, of people, and just what's going on within the Haredi society at large when it comes to treatment of women, discourse about sexuality, vandalizing photos of women and what she's been doing to try to change that. It makes for a great front conversation, very enlightening and interesting about a part of society that we don't always have an opportunity to talk about. So here we go.
On this week's podcast, we have the director and co-founder of Chochmat Nashim, Shoshana Keith Jaskel. And Chochmat Nashim is an organization that advocates for women in the Haredi community. And Shoshana is here to tell us a bit about her work. And some of it has unfortunately become very topical lately after after Chaim Walder, the once acclaimed Haredi author and columnist. And I didn't even grow up Haredi, but I had his books in my house, Kids Speak, which were supposed to help kids be in touch with their feelings. Anyway, it turned out that he had sexually abused many, many women. And after those, after that came out, he committed suicide. And Shoshana, it'd be great if you could tell us a little bit about your organization's initiative after that happened, after this event that really rocked the Haredi world.
Yeah, sure. So first of all, thank you so much for having me. Longtime reader of Jerusalem Post, sometimes writer. And I think you guys are great in general. So Chochmat Nashim has been around officially as an amuta for 5 years, but actually as just volunteer moms and women in the Orthodox community for about 8 years. Started when we saw a lot of extremism in the community and we wanted to do something about it. In terms of Walder specifically, it's an amazing thing when a community decides that they are not going to allow abuse anymore. So I think that what is very special about this movement, as you mentioned, Lahav, Chaim Walder was a very beloved author, not just an author, he was a therapist. He worked officially for the city of Bnei Brak. He was trusted by hundreds of thousands of people around the world who brought him into their homes.
He worked as like a counselor, right? Like
yes, he was a therapist. Yeah. He was a therapist and he was in charge of the needy, the revacha, the social services in Bnei Brak. The neediest people, the most vulnerable, came to him for help. It's really a shocking story, but it's more shocking than someone being beloved who hurt people that he was supposed to help is the response that went on when it became clear that he was not who everyone thought he was. So obviously, as we know, Haaretz broke the story. Then more and more witnesses came forward. And still rabbis and leadership and the paper he wrote for Yetid Ne'eman and the radio station that he had a show on did not, you know, they stood by him until Rav Shmuel Eliyahu had a Beit Din and 22 witnesses came forward and testified in the Beit Din. And that's not even all the people that came out against him, but 22 officially took to the witness stand. And then, as we know, he killed himself. And even after he killed himself, Yetid Ne'eman and his funeral was attended by thousands, and he was praised. And they said, Hashem yikom damam, that Hashem should avenge his blood.
And that the journalists are the ones who killed him.
And that right. The journalists were the one who killed him. And more than that, the people who spoke about how he hurt them killed him. And this is what was too much for Haredi society.
Shoshana, a question though. Chaim Walder is one of a number of cases that we've seen recently within the Haredi community. Now, this happens elsewhere. At the same time that the Chaim Walder story was coming out, there was a story of an educator at a Open Up for Girls, a religious high school in Shalavim named Tzipi Dinar, who's also been suspected now of sexual abuse of students. We saw stories of Rabbi Mati Elon over the years. There have been other cases. So this happens. Meshi Zahav again in the Haredi world. But we're seeing, it feels to an extent, and there's the Berland story of his also, he's a sexual offender and criminal. Is there more going on there? Is there just more awareness today that these stories are coming out? Is it a combination of both? What do you think it is?
I'll answer your question, but answering it because it's very, the campaign that was done by these Haredi activists, I'll explain it very briefly and I'm going to answer your question. Basically, they weren't going to take it anymore. They were thinking of the children in Cheder who were so glad that they didn't tell that their Rebbe touched them because they would have been blamed for their death, right? because Lashon Hara kills. That was the message they were being given in school after Balder killed himself. And the mothers couldn't take it anymore. So they went and they said, we're going to do something. And they raised money and they created gorgeous flyers that explained the situation and had a very, very strong image on it with a little girl whose mouth was being covered by a grown man's hand. And on his wrist was that bracelet that all the kids wear that says, Lashon Hara lo medaber elai, which means slander doesn't speak to me, or I don't speak, you know, don't speak slander to me, double meaning, that Lashon Hara was shutting up the victims. And so now, as a result of these flyers that went all across the country, the stories that are pouring in on these volunteer groups are simply impossible to believe. Not impossible to believe. You believe them. But the stories and the depth, the breadth, Yaakov, of what is happening and how endemic it is, unfortunately, in Haredi society, sexual abuse, is shocking even to those of us who are not unaware, to those of us who have been active in these circles. The people coming out with stories, the hundreds of phone calls that are coming in now to these hotlines as a result of these flyers, I think is even shocking to the people who were involved in it to begin with. It unfortunately is endemic, and it's horrible to say, but I don't know if it's really, really, yes, it's prevalent. Yes, it's more prevalent because people don't talk about it. So if you don't talk about it, so how are you going to stop it? And if you don't talk about it, how are the kids aware? There was a story of a father who sent something to the volunteers who sent out the flyers. He said, I was abused as a child in my school. I never spoke to my kids about it. We never discussed it. But my son came home with one of your flyers the other day and said, you know, Tati, what does this say? And he read it. And he and his child had a conversation about sexual abuse that he never would have done without having seen the flyer. And he himself was someone who was victimized.
So, Shoshana, do you think that this Valder case is a turning point in Haredi society, that they will now, because you're right. I mean, look, we all know sexuality is a taboo topic. You don't talk about things like that, right? Women are covered head to toe. Men are covered head to toe. They don't mingle. They don't discuss. They don't talk. So, of course, anything that has to do with active sex life is something that they're not going to actually speak about. And of course, sexual abuse. But maybe this is the wake up call.
100%. There's no question. There's no going back. This is the point of no return. Haredi society has it has taken this kind of monstrous cover up of a monster to wake up the shetach. I forgot how to say that in English.
To wake up the streets, the people,
Thank
the masses.
You.
Yes.
The masses to say no more. But it has done that. I can tell you the responses that we're getting. And not only that, but from the first set of flyers that were sent out as a result, the volunteers took and went to the rabbis and they said, you need to speak out.
But you this is part of the issue, no? I mean, people are going to rabbis but they're not going to the police, and there's very little trust in the police in the Haredi community. But in the end, the police are the ones who can prosecute these people. And even in the religious Zionist community, I mean, like Rav Shmuel Eliyahu has become this sort of figure who receives these complaints, and now he's receiving them for some of the Haredi community as well in this Chaim Walder case. But again, he's not. I don't even think he's like the Bet Din who would, you know, the religious court that's supposed to be adjudicating this. So how does this go from awareness, which is extremely important, to consequences?
Right. So the first step is change of understanding, the conversation of being okay to speak out. Once it's okay to speak out, and now that these hotlines between Rav Melamed and Tahel are exploding with hundreds and hundreds of calls, they will take the testimonies. They will gather them together. They will see who is a perpetrator, and hopefully they will be taking these cases to the police. Without question, you need authorities. But I have to say that there are already police cases, and the police aren't doing their jobs also, meaning maybe it's an issue of not having enough testimony. Maybe it's an issue of, I'm not sure what, but there was specific one woman, I can give you this specifically, in Telstone, a therapist. There's a police case against her, and she's still a therapist. So. It's you know, it's not just the community. There's a lot that needs to happen for sexual abusers to be prosecuted correctly.
But hopefully this is the beginning of absolute change on the ground. No question. It's going to be, this is a change moment, and it's going to, God willing, ripple all the way through until, you know, they're incarcerated and not hurting people. By the way, there were also people, perpetrators who called the hotlines and said, I have hurt children. Please, if you get calls about me, I will come in and I will cooperate. There's such a non-understanding of what sexual abuse is that even those who perpetuate the abuse, they almost don't even know what they're doing. It's the depth of this is really crazy.
Shoshana, you gave out together with the other activists 350,000 flyers, right? And it was almost like an overnight operation. And I'm curious if there was pushback by people who were getting these flyers, or were they just put into people's mailboxes? Where there's some people who took them and threw them on the ground, said, we don't want them. This doesn't happen. Like, they still turned a blind eye.
So overall, the response was extremely overwhelming. And by the way, between the two sets of flyers, it was a million flyers. It was 2 weeks in a row and three different flyers with three different messages. The overwhelming response was positive. Of course, some people tore it down, but, it was very gentle language. So unless you were actively against any sort of awareness whatsoever, it would be hard for you to say, like, this doesn't belong here, right? The language was modest, and it was speaking to children, or it was speaking to the community itself. It wasn't something that was like, you know, I don't know, like, bullet. It wasn't extreme. It wasn't like offensive. But yeah, of course, there were people who were against it. You know, there were people like, I don't understand why you're doing this, or get out of here. But overwhelmingly positive.
Interesting. I wanted to ask you also, you know, one of the things that I think I've followed you over the years on social media, and, you know, you've written for the Jerusalem Post, and we've interviewed you for articles over time, is as a lot of it's been, there's been sexual abuse, but there's also been this idea of women in pictures, right? And for people who live in Jerusalem, I would say, especially where I live, it's not an uncommon sight to see vandalized bus posters in advertisements with women whose faces have been crossed out or blacked out. I remember a story about a year ago, maybe, or over the summer, where there was someone who was arrested for doing that to advertisements and posters that featured female Holocaust survivors, right? I mean, like, any woman who appears anywhere, you have these, sadly, extremists who come from the ultra-Orthodox community who are blacking out, ripping down, vandalizing these pictures. You created this Jewish Life photo bank, I think, right, at some point. So I'm just curious, how prevalent, first of all, is this phenomenon of vandalizing these pictures? And number two is, explain to us, if you can, what this Jewish Life photo bank is meant to do.
Sure. So first of all, it's very prevalent. And it's so prevalent to the point where there are entire, like, areas where advertisers won't show women, meaning it's not their ideology, but because they're afraid that their posters will be ripped down and they will have to replace them at their cost, they don't even do it, right? So they don't. You can even see D-City and Bank.
One of the banks. Yes.
Took down women off of their advertisements because they didn't want them to be destroyed, right? So it's not just that it's being destroyed, but now what they wanted to do is succeeding, meaning they're saying, we demand a world without women. And now the businesses and advertising agencies are acquiescing to this demand, whether it's because they want to say, look, we just don't want to lose money. It doesn't matter. They're acquiescing to the demand of bullies because these bullies demand a world without women. And if you think that doesn't add to the sexual deviation and the absolutely unhealthy norms within the society, you're wrong. Meaning it's all connected. It's all connected. And that's what Chochmat Nashim talks about. And we say we want to build a healthier orthodoxy. And part of building the healthier orthodoxy is exactly by putting women back in the picture in a normative way and saying, look, the community involves women. The community is a healthy community when there's men and women, boys and girls normally interacting with one another. And that's what the Jewish Life Photo Bank is about. It is literally that, the Jewish Life Photo Bank. And the Jewish life is normally with women and men, fathers, daughters, sons. It's the normal way to be. And so we decided if they're not going to put women back in the picture, we're going to put women back in the picture. It took them 20 years to erase us, by the way. It's only a 20-year phenomenon that Orthodox publications have been erasing women. And it's getting worse and worse and worse. Why? Because people are saying, oh, it's cultural sensitivity. Oh, it's not so bad. It's just a picture. But it's not just a picture. It's not just a picture. It starts with a picture and it winds. Look, I've been spit on. My friends have had rocks thrown at them because women were told you can't be here. Why? Because if I demand a woman-free society, a woman-free environment for myself, and I can force people to do it with modesty signs, then of course I can throw rocks because it's my right not to see you. And that's what happens. So the Jewish Life Photo Bank is there. And by the way, staffed completely by volunteers. Every model that you see there volunteered her face and his face. There are full families that we have to say we want a normal Judaism where women are seen. This is not who we are. And so we're very, very proud to say that we have nearly 1,000 images. We're built more and more. And the photo shoots happened in Israel, photo shoot, Baltimore, New York. People want to do it everywhere around the Jewish world. I'm waiting to go to Australia to get there as well to do it. But it's exciting because the community, and this is what I was saying before, when the community says no more, that's when real change happens. Because it's already illegal to tear down pictures of women. And it's already illegal not to let women advertise with their face. But it still happens because the community accepts it. It's only when the community says no more that there's ever going to be lasting change.
So another major issue that you work on is the agunot, the so-called chained women, women whose husbands will not grant them a divorce. And of course, in Israel, divorce can only be conducted in a religious court. And so if you could tell us a little bit about your advocacy, and I know that there have been some recent victories.
Yes. So it's so hard to call it a victory. Meaning my friend Orly was literally in agunah for 14 years. I mean, she's 41 years old at this point. A lot of her childbearing years passed by. She wasn't able to be with someone because her husband decided he didn't want to give a get. And then he just flew away, meaning he just went and lived elsewhere and nobody could find him. And then there's another woman in the news, 33 years. I can't consider it a victory, right? But what I could say is this. The victories come again when we decide that we're not going to accept it anymore. You're right. There's no civil divorce in this country. You have to get divorced Jewishly, halachically. The problem is that even the rabbinic courts, they aren't run halachically, meaning they'll say, oh, there's nothing we can do. But it's not true. Halacha actually has a lot of solutions for this. Halacha does not want people to suffer. So, for example, why in the rabbinic court does it take, on average, over 2 years to get a decision, a court decision to order a man to give a get, over 2 years in cases of physical abuse, right? So those are the hardest cases. You would think it's the easiest thing to do to order a man to give a get when he's been violent against his wife. But it takes over 2 years on average. So for people who don't have physical abuse, imagine how long that takes. And the point is this, there's so much we can change before we even talk about using halakhic solutions. And that's where we need to put the pressure. See, the good thing about this country, while it does rely a lot on Jewish law, is that we do have civil law. So that while there won't be women on the bench, because right now only men can be dayanim or rabbinic court judges, but there is a committee to elect those judges. And on that committee, thanks to Lisa Levy, I think it was in 2013, they put 4 women on there. We can pressure that committee to hire judges who understand victim mentality, who understand what physical abuse does to someone, who says to a man, you can't make a demand in exchange for her freedom. You come in this room, you are going to say why you don't want a divorce. You cannot demand something in exchange. If you demand something in exchange, you're going to jail. We have that power in this country. We just don't use it. So Chochmat Nashim, again, we work with the community to say, put the pressure on the committee to get the right judges. Don't allow get refusal. There's never two sides to this story. Nobody should be holding anyone else hostage. There's a lot that the community can do, including prenups and postnups.
Can you tell people a little bit about, I mean, I know that's not necessarily Chochmat Nashim's area, but about halachic prenups, I think a lot of people are not aware of.
Sure, absolutely. So in halacha, in Jewish law, a man has to give his wife a get, meaning she cannot say, here's your divorce. He is the one who hands the divorce. She also can refuse, but it's far more often that the man is refusing or extorting in exchange, right? Because there's a loaded gun on the table. So you're like, yalla, let's use it. And I want to get what I want. And also
it's not that hard for a man to just marry a new wife before technically divorcing the previous one. I mean, that's the other thing. Right. It's like only the women's life is put on hold, not the man.
Right. Look, a guy who's a good guy will also not get married again. But yes, his children will never be mamzerim. He will never be an adulterer because technically speaking, a man can't be an adulterer. He's allowed to have as many wives as he wants almost. So correct. It is much, much, the consequences of get refusal is far, far greater for women. So prenup, halachic prenup is basically a very simple document that says, I, the man and the woman sign it. You can sign it before your marriage or after. My husband and I signed it after we got married because I didn't sign it beforehand. That says like this, if one of the spouses wants a divorce and asks for a divorce, the other person can say, I'd like to go to therapy or whatever it is for a couple of months. Usually this is what the document says. There are various drafts of this, but usually it says one can ask for therapy for a certain amount of time. But after that amount of time has ended and the initial person still wants a divorce, the other person either has to give or accept the get, depending on if it's the man or the woman. And if they don't, then they pay a spousal support of 150 or another, you know, schum, that another amount that they put in there, a day to their spouse. So it's not a coerced get, meaning you're not being forced to give the get. You're being incentivized to divorce the person who doesn't want to be with you, especially if you haven't been living together. So it's really a document that two people sign to protect each other from their worst selves, right? Like nobody gets married expecting to get divorced. At the same time, that's what the ketubah is. People don't realize that the ketubah talks about how many goats you're going to give your wife when you divorce her. So we're talking about a document that really protects. And the way it protects mostly is just by deterrence, right? Because if I know I've signed it, I don't want to get into a legal battle. It's a legal document. I don't want to get sued. Yalla, I'm just going to sign it. But also, and this is the most important thing about this document, everyone should sign it because the people who don't sign it are the ones who are going to need it. Meaning, if 80% of the population is signing it, it's something that we do. So then that 20% who maybe wouldn't have signed it on their own, but sign it because of communal pressure and sign it because everyone does it, you're going to see, God willing, you having signed it will protect those people. I hope I'm making sense. It's kind of like a vaccine.
Makes sense. But there are tools, like you mentioned, that the government or the Beit Din or the courts here don't use, right? And they're available and they're accessible. And for some reason, they're deciding not to use them.
100%. Listen, as I said, halacha is a lot more flexible than people a lot of the times. There are tragic cases. Listen, halacha allows for the fact that people are human. There are different halachic tools. We can talk about them if you want to, but it really doesn't matter in the end of the day. But there are ways that a court can dissolve a marriage. Right. Right. Whether it's mental illness, whether it's a breach of contract, whether it's the witnesses were not kosher witnesses. There are ways. Unfortunately, they're very rarely used to free women. They are used sometimes to free people from a momzer status, which is fascinating. But still, sometimes they'll free a child from momzer status, but still keep the woman chained. And I have to say, it's a tragedy that Jewish women don't rank among those that deserve to be freed from chains. It's something that is extremely painful.
One last question, and then we all have to go. But I just have to ask you, how did you get into this line of work, right? I read somewhere you came from Lakewood, New Jersey. That's a pretty religious community in of itself. What took you on this path?
So I moved to Beit Shemesh. I was born and raised in Lakewood, New Jersey. When before Lakewood was Brooklyn, I should say. There was a lot of different kinds of Jews. And for me, a Jew is a Jew. It didn't matter what you had on your head. It didn't matter what you wore on your legs, your pants, skirt, you were a Jew. And when I got to Beit Shemesh and I started to see that really very segmented and this extremism was taking over. Specifically, my daughters were told to sit in the back of the bus because they're girls. You don't tell an American woman to sit in the back of the bus. That's first of all. Second of all, there was the whole Arot Banot scandal was going on. There was a tremendous extremism problem in Beit Shemesh. No pictures of women or girls. And at the same time, my aunt was an aguna. My husband's aunt was being denied a get by her husband. And her husband had fled here. And I wound up being her representative in Beit Din. She was in New York and I was here standing in for her. And I saw firsthand what it is to be a woman with no influence, voice, or power over your own life. And it was, it really was a watershed moment in my life when I expected to go to a religious court and have justice. And I found apathy and ignorance and just a real, not at all what you would expect from some place that purports to have Torah values. And that really set me on this path of being an activist, of fighting for true Judaism, of not allowing people who claim to speak in the name of Torah to abuse in that name. And that's, right. That's what I've been doing for the past 10 years.
Well, interesting. Shoshana, thank you very much for joining us. It was a pleasure to have you on the Jerusalem Post podcast.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this week's Jerusalem Post podcast. If you enjoyed it, please forward it to your friends and family. We're available on all major podcast platforms, and we'll be back next week.